red pilot light on the Fender Twin Reverb is glowing in the dark. It's time for this edition of Before the Soundcheck, the program that offers you a look inside the lives and careers of people who make the music happen. We talk up close and intimately with artists, musicians, producers, and engineers, with the music teachers, the bus drivers, the production crew, the agents, and yes, even the managers. Everyone involved in making the music you love and who bring it to you. Today's program is sponsored by Subsurface Technologies Incorporated. Their Aquafreed well rehabilitation system restores lost water production using environmentally sound carbon dioxide and producing no waste stream. Once water production is restored, AquaGuard maintains the well pump rate and water level, thereby reducing energy costs and putting the system on a sustainable, low-cost path to the future. Subsurface Technologies was green before green was popular. Call 800-283-3353 or visit them at stiwater.com. And now, here's your host, Tony Sarno.
Thank you, Chris, and welcome to the show, everybody. Derek Dyer is a virtuoso rock and R&B saxophone player who has toured and recorded extensively with Joe Cocker and Tina Turner. He has also toured with Brian Ferry, Roger Hodgson of Supertramp, Andrea Bocelli, Christopher Cross, Al Jarreau, and many more. As a band leader, Derek has recorded several solo albums and continues to perform and record with his band and others. Welcome, Derek Dyer.
Tony Sarno, how are you?
Good. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great.
Oh, that's great.
Doing great. On lockdown, but I'm doing great.
Yeah, we all are. It's a new day, isn't it, Derek?
It took a pandemic to get us out of the game. You realize that?
Well, we'll never be out of the game. We talked about that before, right? So besides being a great sax player and one of my absolute favorites, how did you get those gigs? I remember seeing Tina Turner at the Ritz, and I'm not sure if I think Timmy Capello was playing, but you were with her for
Timmy probably was.
You were playing with her for a long time. And which came first, the Joe Cocker gig or the Tina Turner gig?
Just to give you an idea how crazy this business that we're in. So the short story is I was found living in Bermuda. I grew up in Bermuda. And there was a band from the Boston area called American Standard. They were playing for college weeks down there. So my band would do, you know, a set, and then American Standard would do a set. And anyway, after 6 weeks, they talked me into joining the band. And that was in, I think, April of 75. But I have finished out my contract, and I moved to America, to Boston, in September of 75. And American Standard was managed by a guy called Dan Cole, who was friends with Michael Lang. And in 77, that band, American Standard, got hired by Michael Lang to be Joe Cocker's band. And they augmented the band with Bobby Keys, the Rolling Stones sax player, and Nicky Hopkins, the legendary piano player. And then it was like, oh, geez, what the heck is going on here? Catch-up time. So I was with Joe 77, 78, 79. And then I left and just kind of worked the Boston scene for a lot of years and played with a lot of different bands, Jeff Muldaur, Jonathan Edwards, recorded with Rick Ocasek, a lot of local stuff as well. And ended up being in a band signed to Warner Brothers called Fahrenheit. Went to L.A., worked with Keith Olsen, and the record was almost done, and that didn't pan out for me. They decided they wanted to be a three-piece. But I met Jerry Peterson from Billy and the Beaters, and a short time later they had a huge hit called At This Moment from Family Ties. And I called him to congratulate him, and Jerry's the one that told me about the Tina gig. And I said, well, do you mind if I go after it? And he said, listen, Jack Bruno, the drummer in Tina's band, is a very good friend of his. So he sent my bio to Jack Bruno, and after waiting and knowing that they were auditioning a lot of people, Tina didn't like anybody. And I finally got the call. And I flew out to L.A. and walked into this giant rehearsal room. Her standing in the middle of the room, shooting daggers at me because the plane was delayed. It was January and the weather was horrible. And finally, as I walked up to her, she started laughing. She said, "I told everybody to give you an attitude for being late." So she said, "Get your sax out. Let's see what you can do." And so I set my stuff up. Rory Madden, our monitor engineer, set up a mic for me. I said, "No, I'm using my clip-on." And I found out later on that he thought that I was really brazen for doing that. I said, "Well, I'm going down my way."
That's great.
And so we played. She threw everything at me. Tons of tunes. I was ready. Killed it. And so I literally went from my basement after thinking I'd lost the gig with the next big band out of Boston to the number one tour in the world. Learjets, the whole nine yards.
She had her own Learjet?
We had a private plane in when we did America. Every so often they put us in on Learjets, depending. There was one time we played, I don't know, a stupid amount of shows at Wembley in London. It was like 10 shows. We were there for 2.5 weeks. And before we were set to leave, we had a travel day with a night off, but Bowie was in town, and she wanted to go see Bowie, and she didn't want to go alone, so she made them keep the band in London another night. And to make so that meant the off day, we were still in London. The following day was a show day. So they hired 3 Learjets to get her and the band to, I think we were up in Copenhagen somewhere. And we played the show, got back on the Learjets, and they flew us down to the Black Forest in Germany. And we had like 4 or 5 days off or something. I got paid a lot of money to have an amazing time. Great band, spoiled rotten, just, you know, crazy stuff. Crazy.
You've played in my band on some little gigs, and it's always a blast. But that's one thing that I don't think people realize is that you'll go from playing in front of thousands and thousands of people, and then you'll be playing a kid's birthday party or something like that.
Well, we're musicians.
Right.
You know, that's what we do. And if you're lucky, you get to make it to the top of the mountain. That doesn't mean that you're going to stay there. But I think Peter Frampton said it best is, you know, if you're a musician, there's highs and lows. But if you can still get to play, then we're all pretty damn lucky is what it comes down to.
And what about the home front when you're out there on the big road, Derek?
First of all, your wife's got to be unbelievably supportive and understanding. And Christine, my wife, and I had a deal where we wouldn't be apart more than 3 or 4 weeks at a time.
Oh, so that's awesome, Derek.
Yeah, she'd come out a lot. And that was kind of my deal with Joe, you know, when I went back for the third time. And but Joe was great. Joe loved Christine, and he welcomed her whenever with open arms, you know, which I was very lucky for. There are tours that, you know, kind of get weird about it. But
Joe seems like it was more like a family kind of thing on the road, wasn't it?
Joe was, he was just a really nice man. It's a shame that in a lot of ways, in America, people only really remember him for the difficult years, you know, when he really had substance abuse problems and stuff like that. But he was nothing but a wonderful man to me. He was generous, kind, thoughtful, very bright. And it was the Joe most people in America didn't really know. You know, if they did, they would have loved him a lot more.
Well, I think it really comes through in his music. I remember, of course, watching the Woodstock movie. I was I was floored and loved it the minute I saw it. And to this day, when I hear Joe, it's an experience that you can't explain. And I think the reason is that his personality comes through that music. He really expressed himself, and they gave him a bad time, Saturday Night Live with the Belushi thing picking lobsters off his back and all that stuff.
Yep.
But
he was set up there. He fired his manager after that. And he was just kind of set up to look stupid just because the manager thought they could sell more tickets or something. I don't know.
Well, Of course, Saturday Night Live to me was never that big a deal. I watched it and it had this big aura about it. But for my money, Mad TV was really the good show. And so Saturday,
I get it.
Yeah, so
totally get it. I mean, and I'm with you. In the early days for Saturday Night Live, I kind of understood it better. The characters and Belushi and Aykroyd doing the whole Blues Brothers thing, which was kind of helpful to a lot of the blues artists and stuff. Of course, I worked with Matt Guitar Murphy in a band out of Connecticut, so I stole a lot from that guy.
But I mean, I never saw it as making fun of Joe. I thought it was fun, but Belushi was kind of like that, and I didn't take it seriously. That's amazing that the manager, it was taken so seriously. Did Joe just feel humiliated, or?
Joe was a pretty sensitive guy, and he was just a really sensitive guy, and I don't think he really understood what was going to happen. And it was a problem, and he got rid of the manager. And wow. that's when Michael Lang came in, I think.
And Michael Lang, for the people that don't know, the young people, he was one of the organizers of Woodstock, right?
He was essentially the main guy. There was two of them, and then of course they had a lot of money backers and stuff. But Michael was a huge part of putting that whole event together.
Let's play a song off your album, Renaissance Man, I've Got to Use My Imagination. We'll be right back. Are there any stories that you'd like to share with us about the Tina Turner experience?
Went to New York, my wife and I, and saw the new Tina Broadway show. And I was pleasantly surprised. I wouldn't have gone unless my wife should push me into it, but she really wanted to go see it and stuff. So, but they did a wonderful job of tying all the music together without making it into a real big production, and really kind of took the important parts of the story and connected it together using a lot of the tunes from, obviously, her wonderful catalog.
Who played Derek Dyer?
Well, it's interesting they say that because as they, it's kind of where I was getting it. It was mainly a big portion of the Broadway show was the early years, how she started out, her time with Ike, and then connecting to Roger Davies, her manager, and the play essentially finishes at one of the most spectacular moments of her career, which was when she played the Maracanã, which is the biggest soccer stadium in the world, in Rio. It holds about 200,000 people. And she was the first female artist to sell out that size venue. And that was pretty much about halfway through our Break Every Rule tour. And it's amazing to be sitting in the audience and see that this is presented as her moment. And then it's time for the sax solo, and they dressed the guy with exactly what I was wearing. It was pretty damn funny.
That's great.
That was just an amazing time. It was a live HBO broadcast to America, and just another amazing highlight in that 2 years of living in rarefied air, you know.
He didn't have the silver saxophone, did he?
Well, I wasn't looking close enough to see. I'm a little old now, so the eyes don't work as well as they used to.
Well, I'm typically not that observant of something like that, but I always think of you with that silver saxophone. Is there any significance to that?
Just love that particular horn. I was on tour with Joe in France, and I became very friendly with Jérôme Selmer, who is one of the sons of the family that owns Selmer saxophones. And I went to the factory and I picked that one out, and that's just been my favorite horn ever since. You know, that's the one that kind of speaks to me.
Well, that's, I'm sure you played that on this song. We're going to play another one of your songs, Derek, called Nessun Dorma.
So the story with this is, I'm a melody guy more than anything. I love to play rock and roll. I'm not really a jazz player at all. I'm an R&B rock and roll player, but a melody guy more than anything. And I first took notice of this song when Aretha Franklin took over for Pavarotti at the Grammys. He was sick, couldn't do it. And Aretha came on and sang Nessun Dorma, which is an aria from an opera, Puccini opera. And I love the melody so much, I took it to the guys that I play with a lot, Mitch Jacor and Cliff Goodwin and Marty Richards and David Hull with Jen Anders, and said I wanted to record it. So they helped me arrange it and actually turn it into an R&B tune. And it's a very different rendition. I think we did justice to it. It's a beautiful melody done in a very different way.
Well, let's play a little bit of that. This is Derek Dyer's album, Renaissance Man, and the song is Nessun Dorma.
Correct. We'll be right back. kid in Bermuda ends up living in America, having such a wonderful career, and still, I'm still ready to take on those young pups. I can still get it done.
Absolutely. And you were, but you were born in Ireland, weren't you, Derek?
Yeah, dad, mom and dad were musicians too. Mother was a singer, and my father was a really great trumpet player. And of course, they were moving all the time when we were kids. So I was born in Ireland. And then when I was 10 months old, my father moved back to England. So I grew up in England until I was 11. And my father used to play with like Sammy Davis Jr. and Bette Midler and Shirley Bassey. He was really a fine player. And then the Beatles came along, put him out of business in 1966. And so he was offered a gig in Bermuda, and he moved the whole family to Bermuda in 67. And so I essentially, those are the years I really remember. That's where I grew up, one of the most beautiful places in the world, Bermuda. Incredible. I've lived a charmed life.
Your dad toured with those people?
Well, he used to play at a club in London called the Pagal, which was a really, really famous nightclub. And they would bring different shows in all the time. And he was in the house band. So whatever artist came through, he could read and play anything. He was just unbelievable lead trumpet player.
Did he teach you?
He taught me a lot of stuff. He had a great understanding of the saxophone and the mechanics of it. And then I get exposed to the other reed players that he was working with, so I learned a lot from them. But I never went to school, pretty much kind of playing with all you loud rock and roll guitar players.
I know.
Only ever wanted to be the fifth Beatle. That was it, you know, as a sax player.
Well, there's nobody I'd rather play with than you, Derek, the greatest sax player, man. I always love playing with you, man. And looks like we've come to the end of our half hour, Derek, but we'll have to do it again. It's been really great talking with you. And Derek Dyer, you can find his album Renaissance Man, I believe, on Amazon. Is that correct?
It's on Amazon, iTunes, Spotify. It's pretty much in all your digital outlets. And take a listen. I think you'll like it.
All right, great. Derek, thanks so much for being
here. Pleasure, Tony. Always a pleasure. You be well. Hopefully we'll get to play together soon.
All right, man. Good to talk to you.
Rock on.
Thanks, man. Bye-bye.
Cheers, Tom.
Well, that was a real treat. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Derek is an amazing player, and if you go to his website, there's a video up there of them. I think it was in Rio, and it's like, what did he say? A couple hundred thousand people, and he's out on that long runway playing. He opens up the show with his sax, and it's pretty amazing. And to think when we play these parties and stuff, as he says, though, as musicians, we got to work. Like many of you, the musicians in Nashville haven't been able to work in the clubs for almost 3 months now. It's beginning to open up. And there was a new club that opened just before everybody got shut down. And it's called Bowie's down on 3rd Avenue in Nashville. And it's one of my favorite clubs now of all time. I mean, they have a big stage and lights, and PA is great, and the place is great. We got a chance to play there once before they shut down. And so if you get downtown, they're starting to open up. I don't know when they're going to have live music again, but I think the kitchen's open to start with. And so swing by Bowie's on 3rd Avenue and get a cheesesteak. I think they got hot chicken. Never had Nashville hot chicken. Be careful. It's really hot. When I think about that time Derek talks about being with Tina and Joe, I was in New York. We had a band called the D. Archer Band, and we opened up for Joe Cocker at the Ritz, which was a great club, and got to meet him. And actually, some of the guys, Derek wasn't with Joe at that time, but some of the guys that I ended up playing with when I was with Bose were in Joe's band. And it's kind of funny how that works. 20 years later, we'd be playing together. But we also, I remember going to see Tina. Tina was doing her comeback, and she did 3 nights at the Ritz, and I went to all 3, and it was quite amazing because she's quite a performer. No, I think Derek was with Joe, but he was not with Tina. That's what it was. Yes, that's right. We talked about that. Timmy Capello was playing sax with Tina, and I don't know if any of you ever seen Tina Turner. You can see it on video now, but Timmy Capello is this big guy, big muscles, and he'd get out there and flex his muscles and stuff. And funny, I ended up years later, I played a bar mitzvah with him. I was on a gig with him. I think he's still a band leader up in New York. Well, this has been a lot of fun, and I'm Tony Sarno. Thanks so much for listening. I'd like to thank Bridget Cohnhorst and Chris Lucky and Ronnie Lake at Hippie Radio 94.5 in Nashville. I also want to thank our sponsor, Subsurface Technologies. Call them at 800-283-3353 or visit stiwater.com. You can reach me at tonysarno.com and Tony Sarno Music on Facebook and Instagram. Before the Sound Check is a production of Marconi Records. The theme song is Spirit by the Thunderhawks.